Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program. We have a special event this evening with Dr. Esther Brimmer, who is the Undersecretary of State for International Organizations. Tonight's event is co-organized by the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Commonwealth Club of California, and co-sponsored by the United Nations East Bay Chapter. I am Ann Kenner. I'm a trustee of the World Affairs Council, and it is an absolute delight to be here tonight and to serve as your host and moderator. The World Affairs Council of Northern California invites you to join us in seeking knowledge, expanding your networks, and discovering innovative solutions to global dilemmas. For more information about our organization, please do visit our website at www.itsyourworld.org. The Commonwealth Club of California, co-sponsoring this event this evening, is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, bringing together its nearly 18,000 members for over 400 annual events, ranging across politics, economics, culture, society. And you can find out more information about the Commonwealth Club by visiting their website at www.commonwealthclub.org. Before we begin, I want you to just take a quick note of the blue question cards that you found on your seats when you came in this evening. I encourage you to write down your questions for Dr. Brimmer. She is a wealth of information, and council staff will come around throughout the course of the evening and collect your question cards, and I'll try to ask Dr. Brimmer as many of those questions as is possible during the second half of the program. And also, before we begin, as a courtesy to Dr. Brimmer and your fellow audience members, let me ask you to just take the time to turn off your cell phones. And this being the Halloween season, you turn off whatever noisemakers that you might also be bringing with you. Yeah, you never know in San Francisco. So thank you very much. And it's now my pleasure to introduce our guest this evening. Before her appointment as Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations, Dr. Esther Brimmer served as Deputy Director and Director at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. There she specialized in transatlantic political and security affairs. Appointed to the post of Assistant Secretary for International Organizations by President Obama earlier this year, Dr. Brimmer is currently focused on revitalizing multilateral diplomacy in the United States in order to solve global dilemmas such as humanitarian aid and food security and climate change. Dr. Brimmer is here tonight to discuss the new goals and objectives for United States multinational diplomacy in conjunction with the United Nations. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Esther Brimmer, Assistant Secretary of State for International Organizations.
Thank you very much for that warm welcome. Thank you very much to the World Affairs Council, to the Commonwealth Club, and to all of the co-sponsors. And thank you to all of you to take the time to be here this evening. I understand, of course, with the Bay Bridge out, that getting around the Bay Area is more of a challenge, so maybe you may have had a longer commute to get here, so I really appreciate your taking your time to join us this evening for this conversation. I'm going to spend my time this evening talking to you about what might be considered a remarkable evolution in American foreign policy, and talk particularly about the multilateral aspect thereof. My intention this evening is to spend some time describing a few of the salient features of what President Obama has termed an era of engagement, as well as some of the early actions in this area. But before I do, I'm going to spend a couple minutes on why I'm here. I've been in my current State Department position now for 7 months. And I've been in and out of government for almost two decades now. But I came to this position determined to seize the opportunities to meet with interested Americans around the country, to discuss our foreign policy priorities, to listen to your thoughts and your recommendations on those priorities. So this is a very good opportunity for me. Over the coming year, I will make several trips around the country to discuss and hear about views about U.S. engagement with the United Nations and to solicit feedback on our policies, particularly from Americans such as yourselves who take a particular interest in multilateral issues, who are interested in and knowledgeable about multilateral affairs. one of the world's largest and most globally integrated economies, and with a leading role that this state is playing, I'm really glad I'm able to start these conversations here in California. And frankly, if you're going to talk about multilateral issues, you should come to San Francisco, where, of course, we signed the UN Charter. So I'm glad to be doing that here, and this city in particular. I'd like to frame my thoughts about this new era with an important and, I believe, self-evident premise. We live in an increasingly interconnected world, and that those connections encompass a broad and growing network of actors and decision makers in international society, including individuals, national governments, the media, non-governmental organizations, and the private sector. This expanding network is perhaps most visible through the family of UN and other international organizations, a fact which I believe argues for an invigorated engagement across the spectrum of multilateral institutions. I believe that for two reasons. First, because engagement with these various multilateral bodies directly supports U.S. national security interests. Interests, I might add, that encompass, of course, the classic security challenges such as nuclear proliferation issues, but also new concepts of security such as food security and civilian protection issues. But secondly, our active engagement in a host of UN and other international organizations secures and extends significant tangible benefits to American citizens and the American economy. Let me take a moment to elaborate on that before discussing more of the details of our larger foreign policy goals. I'll begin by noting that some Americans have been long-standing supporters of the UN, and others, on contrast, there's a smaller contingent, but a notable contingent is also outright hostile. But there's also, I think, a large group in the middle that may be have ambivalent feelings towards the institution. I think it's important that we address all of those communities. I will say that, that while most of us are familiar with our country as a financial supporter of the UN, as active in bodies such as the Security Council, many people may not be aware of many of the other aspects of our interaction with the UN and larger activities of the UN system as a whole. For example, let's take some of the work done around the UN system. Let's take intellectual property rights. I would think an issue of considerable interest in states like California that are home to some of the most innovative and unfortunately imitated industries in the world. How do you, as Californians and California businesses and investors, ensure that your intellectual property rights are respected and protected around the world, outside of the borders of the United States? How would the state's film and music industries, for example, survive without a legal framework through which to protect their intellectual property rights and to protect those products? Well, the World Intellectual Property Organization, or WIPO, is a specialized UN agency charged with addressing exactly that challenge. Every year, WIPO facilitates more than 250,000 international patent applications from American individuals and businesses, and maintains the system of safeguards for those patents under their main regime and a series of international treaties. This global system, although imperfect, advances the protection of these crucial rights, which in turn encourages creativity, innovation, and economic development in California and around the world. WIPO does what no single state or nation could do, and certainly no business could achieve on its own, and it does this with the active support and participation of the United States. Let's consider another engine of the Californian economy. And I would talk about transportation. I'm going to focus particularly on shipping. If we look whether out in San Francisco or in San Diego or in Long Beach, you have major harbors. And I'll take a moment just to comment on Long Beach, which, as many of you know, is one of the busiest seaports in the world, handling more than 5,000 ships and more than 80 million metric tons of cargo a year. But the global shipping industry's regulatory framework, including safety, security, and environmental standards, are overseen by another UN specialized agency, the International Maritime Organization, or IMO. IMO treaties, standards, and guidelines ensure the smooth and efficient flow of trade between seaports around the world. More specifically, they advance important industry norms such as Long Beach's pioneering environmental protection programs. IMO oversight also directly serves larger national interests by applying security requirements to foreign vessels entering ports in Long Beach, San Francisco, and throughout the United States. In a similar vein, the International Civil Aviation Organization, or ICAO, headquartered in Montreal, ensures that international passenger and cargo flights are handled in a uniform manner from takeoff to landing. If you think about it for just a moment, pilots departing San Francisco International from Manila, Tokyo, or Hong Kong do so in full confidence that they will be able to communicate with air traffic controllers at their destination, receive necessary flight and landing data, and understand airport layout upon their approach. And this is no accident. ICAO standardized procedures advance and enhance technical and operational aspects of international civil aviation, including safety, security, air traffic services, training and technical assistance, and environmental matters. As with the International Maritime Organization, ICAO facilitates efficient and secure trade and transport, without which the global economy would be severely inhibited. One final example, with a particular twist for California audiences, is global communications. Since the first International Telegraph Convention was signed in 1865, the World Committee has adopted a cooperative approach to the development and coordination of new communication tools. As the telegraph gave way to telephonic and radio communications, the International Telecommunication Union, ITU, also in Geneva, was born to coordinate international standards of electronic communication. That role continues today through ITU's management of global radio frequencies for broadcasting, mobile phones, satellites, wireless internet, and disaster operations. Imagine the implications for California's multi-billion-dollar tech and communication industries of a world without such an institution or without U.S. support for such an institution. So when you consider, for example, how the world is responding to the threat of pandemic influenza, how letters and packages are delivered around the world, or how nations exchange important weather information, you should assume that there is a UN organization playing a role and that the United States is a supporter of that role. Now, as I noted at the outset of my remarks, that multilateral engagement directly serves U.S. national security interests, and I'd like to take a few minutes to elaborate on that statement. In the largest sense, credible U.S. leadership at the United Nations diminishes the operating space for those who might actually prefer a weakened international system. The President understands this truth, and speaking at the United Nations last month, he said, quote, "I took office at a time when many around the world had come to view America with skepticism and distrust. Part of this was due to misperceptions and misinformation about my country. Part of this was due to opposition to specific policies and a belief that on certain critical issues, America had acted unilaterally, without regard for the interests of others. And this has fed an almost reflexive anti-Americanism, which too often has served as an excuse for collective inaction," end quote. And so the President has launched an era of engagement, has called upon nations of the world to forsake the old pattern of seeking refuge in our differences, and instead assumed shared responsibility for tackling the pressing challenges of our time. This era is already changing the multilateral landscape, opening doors long shut, restarting conversations long ceased, and giving new impetus to efforts to address our most vexing shared challenges, from classic security challenges such as nuclear proliferation to new concepts of security such as the threat posed by climate change. Ultimately, it is the decision to take these issues back to the United Nations and other international organizations to enable multilateral institutions to fulfill their intended roles that makes real the President's commitment. Take, for example, nuclear nonproliferation. Early in his administration, the President took the momentous decision to recommit to the goal of a nuclear-free world. As the world's original nuclear state, the U.S. action has particular resonance. But the President went much farther. He determined that the goal could not be reached in isolation, but rather in partnership with the international community. Last month, he took the issue to the UN Security Council, where he became the first U.S. president to chair a session of that body. The symbolism notwithstanding, the President had a specific objective. that found form in UN Security Council Resolution 1887, which expressed the Council's grave concern about the continuing threat of nuclear proliferation and called for concrete actions by UN member states, not just the United States, to work towards a world without nuclear weapons. The United States will lead this effort, including working diligently towards the START follow-on treaty, seeking ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, moving toward restarting negotiations on a verifiable fissile material cutoff treaty, and preparing for next year's Non-Proliferation Treaty Review Conference. Turning to another issue, climate change is also an illuminating example. Here, too, the President has charted a bold course, a key feature of which is investment in domestic action, something that can be viewed right here in California. At the same time, he has repeatedly underscored the need for bold global action on what must be a shared global response. As a result, he's triggered a fundamental shift in the U.S. approach to this issue, a shift which includes assuming a leading and constructive voice in the ongoing UN Framework Convention on Climate Change negotiations. These negotiations are intended and expected to yield a meaningful successor to the Kyoto Protocol, a result the United States is eager to see realized. I mentioned at the outset that the President's era of engagement encompassed both classic and new concepts of security. One of the issues that until now recently fell outside the classic concept of security is gender-based violence, including violence against women and girls in post-conflict zones. The fact that Secretary Clinton is a global figure on women's rights and empowerment goes without saying. Among the most recent demonstrations of this fact was her trip to Africa, where she spent time in the Democratic Republic of Congo, meeting with victims of gender-based violence and exploring many of the vulnerabilities of women and girls face in conflict and post-conflict situations. She returned from that trip to share, she returned from that trip to chair a special session of the Security Council last month, specifically called to address questions of women, peace, and security in armed conflict. The result was a groundbreaking session leading to Security Council Resolution 1888, outlining the need for urgent action to meet the needs of women and girls in conflict situations. I'm very pleased to note, on in a related area, that there's also been another interesting development in multilateral action. In early September, with firm U.S. support, the U.N. General Assembly approved Resolution 311, which establishes a path toward a consolidated and strengthened U.N. gender architecture. The intent of this resolution is to create a single U.N. gender entity, which is empowered more effectively, more coherently, and more globally to promote women's rights, gender equality, and empowerment. Frankly, for too long, these efforts have been segmented and at times disassociated and poorly resourced and without clear authority within the system. Despite being more than 3 years in the making, this effort has new momentum, the goal of which is a unified gender platform combining skills and energies of four existing agencies with real political momentum behind it, and the United States will work vigorously with other member states to put it into effect. Another issue which falls inside this new expanded concept of security is food security. Indeed, given the fact that upwards of 1 billion people on this planet are undernourished or malnourished, it can hardly be viewed in any other context. Here again, President Obama is taking bold action, not just to respond to the challenge, but to materially alter the global architecture and approach underpinning current food security efforts. In April, the G20 met in London, where the President again prompted international action first through domestic leadership. In this instance, he announced his intent to ask Congress to double U.S. agricultural assistance to more than $1 billion in 2010 and at least $3.5 billion over the next 3 years. This request and the President's accompanying vision effectively catalyzed and invigorated an international response that has now generated $20 billion in new resources to take on this challenge. The intent here is clear. We must identify and support a more comprehensive global approach that closes the gap between development and humanitarian assistance. Secretary of State Clinton elaborated this approach last month, and it includes increased investment in sustainable and country-led agricultural growth, expanded efforts to prevent and treat undernutrition, alignment of U.S. policy and development efforts around common goals, and accountable programs with benchmarks and targets. But to clarify, this new effort on food security in no way diminishes U.S. leadership on humanitarian food assistance programs. The United States is and will remain the world's largest contributor to such programs, including through the UN World Food Program. Another word about a key issue that's undergoing important evolution at the UN with U.S. input, peace operations. Here again, the President has identified a key security issue that merits enhanced and expanded attention on the UN stage and has taken steps to invigorate the related conversation. While in New York, we met with the leaders of the top troop-contributing countries to discuss means of strengthening peace operations and hear their views on steps toward that end. As a result of that meeting and additional consultations, the administration is working in several areas. We're working to ensure that mandates for peacekeeping operations are credible and achievable. We're working to intensify efforts to mediate conflicts and revive flagging peace processes, to expand the pool, capacity, and effectiveness of troop and police contributors, to help the UN mobilize critical enabling assets such as field hospitals, engineers, transport, aviation, also to look at the possible provision of more U.S. military officers, civilian police, and civilian personnel to UN missions, and increase attention to peace-building activities, which can help build up national government's capacity to take over when you take over from UN peacekeepers, particularly in the realms of governance, security, and the rule of law. One final example of this changing multilateral landscape, this time in relation to human rights and specifically to the U.S. decision to join the UN Human Rights Council. The Council has been the target of some justified criticism, particularly with respect to their repeated and largely unhelpful treatment of Middle East issues. As a result, our decision to join the Human Rights Council was not entered into lightly and was reached based on clear but a hopeful vision of what could be accomplished there. Here again, the President recognized an opportunity to reinforce the crucial purpose of multilateral fora and the U.S. voice therein. We assumed a seat on the Council in June with a clear sense of the associated challenges, but I'm pleased to report that we have had an early success. Earlier this month, the Council adopted by consensus a resolution affirming the fundamental universal values of freedom of speech, opinion, expression, and freedom of the media. The obvious importance of this resolution was amplified by a twist. This resolution had two sponsors, the United States and Egypt. The President took office talking about extending an open hand, looking for new avenues of cooperation and understanding. He expanded on the spirit of this in his June 4th Cairo speech. I would suggest to you that this resolution, on a larger scale, the full range of issues upon which the United States is re-engaging, is exactly what the President intended. So, ladies and gentlemen, I do not want to leave the impression that the administration believes engagement renders all adversaries powerless and overcomes all obstacles. There will be setbacks. Member states will disagree. Diplomacy is not a zero-sum game, and diplomacy harbors both discord as well as harmony. As the President has said, the UN is imperfect, but yet an indispensable organization. So we will engage. We will work with the UN to make it more effective, more efficient, more agile, and more fully intent upon its founding ideals. I am firm in my belief that this approach will lead the United States to a more secure future. Ladies and gentlemen, I will end my comments there, but I very much would look forward to our conversation on these issues and your thoughts on the administration's approach to multilateral affairs. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brimmer. And as anticipated, we've had a flood of questions, some responsive to your comments and also people just waiting to ask questions of of somebody of your stature and with your level of experience and your deep bench in international affairs. You mentioned that the Secretary of State has made the subject of women's rights a primary focus of her international agenda and explained the administration's perspective on why the issue of violence against women is central to the issue generally of international security. Critics of the administration's approach argue that this focus on women's rights comes at the expense of more pressing issues such as terrorism, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and nuclear proliferation. How would you respond to those critics?
Chris, thank you for the question. I would suggest actually that the administration is actually active on a wide variety of security issues, including work on Afghanistan and Iraq, which are very much at the front of the administration's issues that address in the foreign policy area. However, we're aware that the United States, as a global power, has a wide variety of interests. Therefore, in addition to working on issues that are often on the front page, including Iraq and Afghanistan, which are absolutely crucial because we have men and women serving in the field, both as members of our armed source, as members of our armed forces, as members of our diplomatic corps, as working out with humanitarian groups, and any time we have people serving the field, of course these are fundamental issues on which the President and others will spend a great deal of time. But we also recognize that we need to be active on a wide variety of transnational issues that are absolutely fundamental to global politics, and that as we look out across the globe, the issues that have to do with violence within states are particularly acute, and that those include not only traditional violence between formal militaries, but also non-traditional violence between militias and other types of groups, and too often civilians are caught in these as well. And therefore, when we look at some of the conflicts that where we see this type of gender-based violence, the actual conflicts cannot be resolved unless you deal with these issues too. You need the comprehensive approach to actually ultimately work towards ultimate stability.
Another question along those lines. You mentioned that the UN issued Resolution 1888, which is a specific focus on improving international attention in response to the issues of violence against women. How does the United Nations, given that it is an enormous bureaucracy, to which, in fact, the only bureaucracy to which every country in the world belongs, how does the United Nations make a resolution like this something beyond just a semantic flourish?
Thank you. I'll take a moment to talk about both the creation of Resolution 1888 and then the next steps. That when you bring forth a Security Council resolution, part of it is, of course, working with the other member states about what will be actually the mandate and the text of the Security Council resolution. So you're thinking both about the work and the implementation as you write the resolution. The resolution calls on for the creation of a special rapporteur who would work specifically on these issues. It also asks for the creation of a team of experts who would actually work in the field. The idea is they would be available for worldwide activities, and so that the idea then would be to actually organize and fund teams that would go to areas of particular concern, which is part of the practical action that would be new resources, new sets of people working on these issues. It also asks for an annual report from the Secretary General, which means that we'd also be able to further monitor the actions of those groups. So the next steps now are to actually name the people into those offices that are discussed in the resolution.
So there is an action plan.
Indeed.
Thank you. We've had a number of questions this evening about the UN's Goldstone Report, and specifically asking why the Obama administration has decided to block the ICC, or the International Criminal Court, from considering the allegations raised in that report, if in fact that's the case.
Actually, the question is actually not factually accurate. That I want to give you first from the background. The what we call the Goldstone Report was the report of the Commission of Inquiry, which was tasked by the UN Human Rights Council in January. This was before actually the United States was a member of the Council. We were not members till later on in the year. The original mandate of the Commission, unfortunately, was extremely one-sided. Maybe you'll be familiar if you had a chance to read it. At the time, many of the member states who were then members of the Council already expressed concern
concern about the how the mandate was actually written. Now, of course, Justice Goldstone is an internationally respected jurist and who's a serious person trying to address a difficult situation. However, that when the report was actually produced, that there was a great deal of concern by the United States and others about the actual content of the report. And it's challenging because the actual issue, the question of accountability, is an incredibly important issue. And the United States and other member states are deeply concerned about how to address accountability issues in situations of armed conflict. This is an important question for all UN member states to think about. However, the concern with the report is that it also is extremely imbalanced and between the parties and its discussion of the parties. The other challenge is that if you actually look at it, it's 575 pages long. If you actually go look at the content, the actual recommendations go well beyond the mandate of the actual commission to areas that are not in the purview of the Human Rights Council. The report calls for a wide variety of actions. We think that the place to address the Goldstone report is in the Human Rights Council, because that's where we talk about human rights issues, and that's the body that actually empowered the commission. We think it would have been most beneficial to give the parties a chance to address the issues themselves. Ultimately, the first place to address accountability issues is with domestic mechanisms. The precipitous holding of a special session meant that there was a special session at the Human Rights Council before the parties even had a chance to really address the concerns within the report or related concerns. So I would note that the report has not been referred to the ICC. So the question, that's why I say the question was not factually accurate. The first body that's considered has been the Human Rights Council.
And just a question with respect to the Human Rights Council. I know that, Dr. Bremer, you were instrumental in the Obama administration's decision to resume a seat on the Human Rights Council. The council currently has about 47 member nations, and a number of our audience members point out that some of those member nations are frequent and flagrant human rights violators. How will the Obama administration avoid legitimizing those violators and those violations by sitting on the council and attempting to work through these issues with them?
Thank you for the question. As the question notes, the United States became a member of the Human Rights Council this year. The Human Rights Council is a new body that historically the main body working on human rights issues at the UN had been the UN Human Rights Commission. The commission was completed its work in 2005. A new body was created to try to deal with some of the problems that the commission had faced, one of which was an increasingly large number of states on the commission that were not defenders of human rights, which chose to get on the commission to try to keep away international attention from their own internal human rights records and other challenges. So the original effort was a reformist one, creating the new council. However, the new council, as you know, has 47 members. They are voted on board, and at the time of the election, the countries that are voting do have an opportunity, to review the human rights records of the countries that go on board. However, that not all the countries that serve on it have taken a strong stance in support of universal human rights values. I would suggest, though, that if you want to defend the fundamental values in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you have to be a member of the body that actually manages the implementation of those values. You cannot do that from the sidelines. So even if you are not, even if you have concerns about the membership of that group, it is better to be in the body trying to work for the best resolutions possible, trying to make your case rather than being outside the body. And that actually, it's not as if you legitimize the activities of other member states, you legitimize the value of human rights and the fact that the global body should address human rights. That's what you legitimize by being a member of the Human Rights Council.
Thank you, Dr. Bremer. We have one questioner who's quite concerned about the direction that the Obama administration is going to take with respect to Iran and North Korea. Is there any reason why we should not have normal diplomatic relations with these countries, and when can we expect the doors for diplomacy to open?
Thank you for that. Thank you for the question. The United States, of course, is particularly concerned to make sure that all countries meet their obligations, particularly in the most serious security areas. And we have concerns both with Iran and North Korea, neither of which are meeting their international obligations in the nuclear area. And therefore, we're particularly concerned about their behavior internationally. I'll take just a moment on Iran, since we're at a particularly important moment there. As you know, the United States has been pursuing a track both of extending a hand to Iran, saying that if Iran wants to participate internationally and meet its international obligations, that the administration has extended an open hand to them. However, it also needs to comply with its obligations to the International Atomic Energy Agency. As you may know, the IAEA put together a package to try to address the question of the low enriched uranium in Iran. It tried to put together a package which would allow reprocessing of that or uranium, saying that yes, that if you're pursuing peaceful uses of nuclear energy, that of course is permitted under the treaties, and that therefore here is a mechanism to facilitate Iran's peaceful use of nuclear energy, and that reprocessing that could be done outside the country and then provided back to Iran for use or for energy purposes, but clearly not for weapons purposes. This offer is currently on the table. We'll see what Iran chooses to do, but this is to say that the international community, including the United States, is trying to find a way forward that will allow them to meet their commitments, and we'd hope they take advantage of this opportunity from the international community.
There's a lot of curiosity, of course, about the Security Council membership and whether or not you see the council expanding in terms of its permanent membership and what the Obama administration's official position is on that question.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. As the President has said earlier this year, he is committed to the United Nations, committed to the Security Council, which is currently a vital and legitimate body. We also want to be sure that it remains a vital body in the 21st century, and he said that the Security Council should reflect the realities of the 21st century going forward. Of course, there's been a long discussion, debate over the years about the composition of the Security Council, but we should note that the Security Council has only been formally expanded once in 1965, and that therefore that the composition of the Security Council is an important issue, a fundamental issue, but not one that is addressed lightly. The administration is looking at all of the proposals that have been put forward for expansion, the permanent membership of the Security Council. As you know, there are several proposals have been put forward in the United Nations context. There is currently a working group which was begun in the 63rd session of the General Assembly, which will continue now in the 64th session. We participate along with other member states. And so we're looking closely at all of the proposals and listening to those. But, of course, ultimately we want to be sure we maintain the effectiveness of the Council. So we'll continue to look at those ideas, continue to review the options available.
Thank you. You spoke this evening about the issue of food security as being essentially inextricably entwined with our international security, and certainly Secretary Clinton recently addressed the UN General Assembly on this subject. You noted that one of the UN resolutions was to promote country-led plans. Mm-hmm. And that the United States has, I believe, committed over or up to about $1 billion to facilitate those country-led plans. It's fair to say that previous efforts in this regard have been rife with corruption and waste. How do you see things being different this time around, and what can the Obama administration do to promote actual and effective delivery of materials and resources to country-led plans?
Absolutely. Thank you. As you mentioned, the Secretary is taking a particular leadership role on these issues on behalf of the administration, hosting an event with the Secretary General last month in New York, attended by over 130 countries, looking particularly at launching the food security issue. And in her remarks, she made a point of talking about both the effort to empower farmers, and many of whom are women, working on small plots of land and looking at how you can improve the technology and productivity of those farmers, as well as the ability to get food to market, particularly given the explosion of cities. And so she said that you really want to be looking particularly at how you empower those groups in particular. And so therefore, one of the things we're trying to look at are how you actually improve the mechanisms for delivering that aid in particular. And there are several places where we need to work. As I mentioned, while this is a U.S. initiative, it's done in cooperation with the international community and in particular with the food agencies, the U.N. food agencies, which are based in Rome. One is the Food and Agriculture Organization, but one of the areas we've been working on is particularly improving the management of the FAO, and there's actually a program now where, and one of the reasons we're working hard on trying to improve the actual ability of the FAO to conduct plans and monitor them is to make sure they'd be better able to handle these issues in particular. We're also looking at the Food and the International Fund for Agricultural Development, also based in Rome, and working also on trying to improve the ability to monitor how the funds are actually spent. We're also working with international financial institutions and other institutions, looking again at what mechanisms would need to be set up to actually implement the food security issues. There will be a food security summit in Rome in November, so currently negotiations are looking at how do you create these mechanisms, both to actually make sure that the assistance gets where it's needed and that we're able to track it and implement it in a really serious and careful way.
Along those same lines, what, if any, protocols have been planned to deal with the issue of climate change through multilateral diplomacy?
As I mentioned in my remarks, the approach to climate change is one of the new developments, important changes with the administration. The president has, of course, many times expressed his concern with the global impact of climate change and the important role it plays in American foreign policy. I will note that on his first visit to the UN General Assembly, even the day before he gave his speech, his head of state speech, that he actually went to the event hosted by the Secretary General of the UN on climate change to demonstrate the importance that the United States put on it. But note that he went as the chairman of the Major Economies Forum. And one of the important steps the United States has taken is to take the major economies conversation and link it directly to the global UN conversation, which is part of the UN framework on climate change conversation, which the next element of which, of course, is the Copenhagen conference coming up next month. And if we look at the basic outlines of the discussion, the idea is that every state has a responsibility for taking on climate change, but that the types of responsibilities will vary a bit by the type of country. So if we look at the developed countries, the United States and others, the developed economies, where the focus here is looking particularly at carbon emissions reductions from a certain baseline. The discussion is how the developed countries work on that particular package with the cap and trade in the next step. It's also complemented, of course, by domestic actions. Then there's a question of the role for the major emerging economies. And here the idea is that they also have a responsibility for grappling with climate change. This includes China, India, Brazil, and the other large developing economies. But it does recognize that they were not part of the past century of development. It says, while we have a shared future, that there we're looking at how they develop sustainable development programs that also deal with emissions issues. A third group of countries are countries which are the smaller developing countries, which are less wealthy countries. They're not being asked to undertake specific commitments, but as they begin their greater development efforts, that they also look at sustainable developments and consider the carbon footprint as they develop. It's incredibly important because if we look at where the growth in carbon emissions is likely to come, the International Energy Administration, they estimate that 97% of the growth in carbon emissions will come from the developing world. So it's important that both the developed and the developing world recognize that we all have responsibilities here, but how we implement them will vary by the economy. And it's that balance that the negotiations are trying to grapple with at this point.
Thank you, Dr. Roemer. The Bush administration had a notoriously prickly relationship with the United Nations. One stated reason for this was the United Nations' putative bias towards member nations whose interests are antithetical to those of the United States and its allies. How does the United States work productively with member nations who are highly critical of our nation's democratic policies and principles?
Thank you. I mean, one of the challenges of working multilaterally, particularly at the global level, is that you have 192 member countries, and you're not going to agree with all of them all the time. And one of the things that, when you look at the purpose of the global body, something like the General Assembly, and particularly the General Assembly is a global membership organization. It is designed to air a variety of views, that is, which means that we will hear a variety of views, some of which will be things that we do not like. But the idea is that each state is able to express its view, but we also are able to express our view and to bring other states over to our point of view by making our best case. And we are always willing both to stand up for American values and principles, and at times it may mean that we may be voting by ourselves. At times, if we need to do that, we will do that because there are certain things we will always support. But we also think it's important to explain why we choose to take our actions, to explain to other states where we can find our shared interests. And often, sometimes, we have to reach across old divisions, old barriers, old divides to say that we may find partners in places we didn't traditionally look. And so we're trying to overcome some of the traditional regional divisions, some of the traditional economic divisions, and say that there are areas where we have common responsibilities and look for partners in new places and new ways.
You know, a further question along those lines. Colin Powell once remarked that as a result of unilateral behavior or activities in the prior administration, the United States had essentially checked its credibility at the door. How does this administration respond to that concern, and what has been our reception at the United Nations? And I'd specifically ask you to refer to some of the anecdotes you were sharing with me about your experience taking the seat on the Human Rights Council.
All right, thank you. I will raise two particular points. One is, as you mentioned, I had the privilege of actually being in Geneva on the day the United States formally became a member of the Human Rights Council on September 14th, and I had the honor of actually giving the speech. We were particularly pleased that the Human Rights Council made time for us. It made time for the United States to actually give a speech on the day that we became members. I think that in and of itself was a testimony from the Council itself welcoming us back. It was actually thrilling to walk in the room, which was standing room only, and realize that people wanted to hear what the United States had to say on human rights issues. And it was really a really thrilling moment. I will always treasure being able to give the speech and say the United States cared deeply about international human rights issues and wanted to be part of the global body addressing those issues. But then to the first part of your question about how you actually, what this means actually in terms of engaging in diplomacy. I think one of the things that we find, and particularly I say my bureau, which houses the diplomats who work with the UN organizations who are around the world, is that we find that we go to a lot more meetings. We go to a lot more events because we think it's important that we actually participate actively in the various mechanisms of the human rights system. So it means that we go to events, we go to meetings, we meet with member states on a regular basis where we're frequently talking to member states about the issues that they care about so we know what they're also trying to get out of the UN system. So we both explain our position, but we are listening to what other states have to say. It means, I think, that all my colleagues are working a lot longer hours because it means you go to a lot more meetings and in a lot more places. We're active in all of the UN cities, but it's part of our, as I say, the day in, day out work to try to realize the vision of being engaged actively on multilateral diplomacy.
You mentioned, and it's been widely celebrated in San Francisco, that the United Nations is, in fact, celebrating its 60th anniversary. Many admirers and detractors of the organization have noted that the geopolitical model that supported its creation is really no longer relevant, and that the UN may have lost its relevance. How does the Obama administration respond to the UN's institutional rustiness?
Well, I think one of the remarkable things is to look at how our international organizations have expanded to accommodate dramatic changes over the past 60 plus years. That first, if you think it was approximately 51 states that founded the United Nations signed the charter here in San Francisco. One of the remarkable things is to look at the fact that we now have 192 member states. We have a vast explosion in the number of sovereign states as we had the end of colonialism and the spread of national governments. And so that's a good thing. That means more states and more people are having control over their own lives. There's still a lot of work to do. But that means that the system has actually expanded to accommodate new states simply as members of the General Assembly. Also, there, as I say, there was one expansion of the Security Council also to account for a larger membership. But I think we have to stop and take a moment and look at this in historical perspective, that we're now asking the question about how we find new roles for the new emerging powers on the global scene, whether it's India, Brazil, and others. That the fact that we're having this question and debating this question in diplomatic settings is excellent. If you look over the past several hundred years of world history, usually the arrival of a new power on the international scene has been done through warfare. Conquering your neighbor, conquering somebody else, that's how you became powerful. The fact that we're talking about expanding leadership in the international world peacefully, integrating new states peacefully, is an incredible accomplishment of which we should all be proud. So the question now is, how do we adjust our institutions looking to the future? And the Obama administration is trying to think seriously about how we make sure that all of our institutions, economic and political institutions, are able and vital to address the changes that we face. And we are seeing new institutions. We look at the G20, which is addressing economic issues in a way they've not been dealt with before. We're thinking creatively about how we work even with our political institutions about what we bring forward. I talked about new concepts of security, but in all of our institutions we're trying to say what's really the core issue we need to address, how can we organize ourselves better to do that. And that's part of the revitalization of our international institutions.
To bring you way down to micro issues, we have a questioner who would like you to discuss whether you believe the U.S. embargo on Cuba has been effective and whether continuation of the embargo is costing the United States support across Latin America.
Thank you. Well, I'll say, as many of you know, that the administration has adjusted policy on Cuba earlier this year, changing and opening up allowing more family travel to Cuba, and so making it much easier for families to visit each other between the United States and Cuba. It's an important development from this administration. I'd also note that the administration is also beginning to look at other forms of communication between the United States and Cuba. As you may know, it's now not possible to send a letter to the United States to Cuba directly. And so one of the areas we're looking at is how do you open up postal communications, which also is another way to facilitate families relating to each other. We noticed that this one in particular because international postal issues is actually handled by our bureau, along in cooperation with the United States Postal Service, these conversations about how we might do that are some of the ongoing efforts, and part of the effort to try to look at the next steps on Cuba policy.
A number of question cards have brought up the problem of the Middle East, and specifically our diplomatic relations with various countries in the Middle East. Do you sense a change in temperature, a thaw in relationships, any sort of movement in diplomatic engagement between Middle Eastern countries and our own country since the Obama administration came into office?
Well, of course, it's a large question that was going to entail a whole another lecture, largely by my colleague, who's actually Assistant Secretary for Near East Affairs, whose purview relations with the countries in that region falls. But just to say that generally, that I think, and of course, there are many countries in this region. You'd really want to talk specifically about each one, as my colleague would do. But I would say that in particular, after the president's speech in Cairo, where he made a point of reaching out to the Islamic world in the Middle East and around the world, that you saw, I think, a real positive response to the president's speech. I happened to have been in Geneva the day afterwards, and it was exciting to have many of the permanent representatives to the UN Geneva from Middle Eastern countries come up to me and quoting back parts of the president's speech, which were particularly moving for them. And so I think that it really is a new approach, I think a fresh approach, trying to start off from a tone of respect that I think will have a larger and longer-term implication. I say it's a much larger issue, but just in terms of the vantage point of what we see in the multilateral bodies resulting from that, we have seen a real positive response to that speech.
Well, Dr. Brumer, we have time, I believe, for just one more question. And if you don't mind, I'm going to make it a personal one. When we were speaking in the green room, Dr. Brumer mentioned that she appreciates a well-run meeting. and I asked her whether she ever has a well-run meeting at the UN. And I'd like to ask her to answer that question for all of us in this public forum, and also to describe a little bit about, given the number of years that you have been involved with the State Department and with issues of diplomacy, what this most recent position has meant to you personally.
Oh, thank you. Well, first, on a well-run meeting is what you did, which is making sure that many people have a chance to express their ideas and that you hopefully have a good discussion. And I've been to some sessions which are really exciting to hear very different countries with very different views having a chance to air their views on a particular question. And so in that sense, you can have some really, really exciting meetings because it's a very different types of countries trying to grapple with a complex question, but recognize they have to do that together. That can be pretty stimulating. May not always run to time, but it can actually be very interesting and part of the ongoing dialogue about trying to create global norms and systems. So that's pretty exciting. And then for me personally, I feel incredibly fortunate to be able to be doing this job. That is an exciting time to be part of this administration, to be working on issues that I think are important for the United States that are directly help the well-being of the American people, but also help try to contribute to a better world internationally. And this is really a very, very exciting time. I think many themes that I've had the privilege to work on over my life have come together in this particular opportunity, and it's I'm really excited every morning when I go to work, and I'm very thankful to be able to be doing this at this time.
Well, you know, we are clearly very lucky to have a professional of your caliber working on our behalf in the State Department. Mm-hmm. And on that note, I would like to ask the audience to join me on behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California, the World Affairs Council of Northern California, and the United Nations Association's East Bay Chapter in thanking Assistant Secretary of State Dr. Brimmer, Esther Brimmer, for sharing her thoughts with us this evening. Thank you and good night.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very well.